is The Fall Line. Carlos Ariel Delgado Mancha has been missing for 25 years, but you won't find him listed on any publicly available database. Search his name and you'll find only one page of hits. A few links to Facebook, a Spanish language article from 2012, and a message board post. Carlos Delgado lived and worked in the United States for the better part of 15 years. He could still be alive today. His niece Sheila and his son Hugo think there are only a few options as to what might have happened to him. Perhaps Carlos purposely went off the radar in 1997, when he had an active warrant out for his arrest and was struggling with substance abuse issues. Perhaps he's been living in housing insecure situations ever since. Perhaps he's reestablished himself, but that's harder for them to believe. He was close to his mother back in Mexico, and besides that, he had his son, Hugo. Would Carlos have failed to reach out to him? But that's only one option. The other option is much worse. Sheila and Hugo worry that Carlos met with foul play sometime in 1997, and his body has either not been discovered or has not been identified. There is very little left of Carlos's trail that can be used to unravel the mystery of his disappearance. There's his temporary residence application, approved in 1988, and obtained for his son Hugo by a lawyer. A few pictures. Arrest records that his family has used to track his movements across Florida. Rumors of time spent in Georgia. But any law enforcement agency or medical examiner or web sleuth hoping to match a person, living or deceased, to a missing persons report would never consider Carlos Delgado. He's one of missing. We only heard his story through the back channels, passed from person to person, until it reached us. Make a podcast about cold cases long enough, and stories and families come to you in all sorts of ways. Submission forms on websites are one avenue, law enforcement calls, recommendations from other families, word of mouth from medical examiners, coroners, caseworkers, advocates. Sometimes we get referrals from other organizations who can't help but think we might be able to. And we do the same in return, connect those who need help with those who can offer it. And then there's social media. That's how we became aware of Carlos's case. His name traveled from one person to another through a system of Facebook groups for the missing, the unidentified, and the murdered, until a forensic expert in another southern state connected us with his niece, Sheila Perez. She prepared us for the fact that there wouldn't be any available information on his case. We've talked about the concept of the missing on this podcast before. Many people can fall into that category depending on their life circumstances. It might be that someone is not reported missing and turns up as an unidentified decedent. Drug and alcohol dependent people whose loved ones are used to them being gone for weeks or months and may not realize that they're truly gone, they can become the missing. So can unhoused people, undocumented people, sex workers who operate in unsheltered conditions, runaway juveniles, immigrants without family in the country to report them missing, members of the LGBTQ+ community whose chosen family may not be taken seriously when they attempt to file missing person reports. The list goes on. The missing are a large and varied group of individuals with circumstances that can and do intersect. In Carlos's case, there were several factors at play, but his family knows he's gone. The problem is getting anyone else to listen, and that may come down to red tape. As far as anyone knows, Carlos was last known to be living and working in Georgia and Florida. It's believed he disappeared while in the latter, though his niece Sheila and his adult son Hugo can't be totally sure. They are the two people who continue to look for Carlos, and they've also tried to have his case opened with multiple law enforcement agencies. But they haven't had any luck. Sheila, who lives in Washington, she's made calls to Florida and Georgia law enforcement. And Hugo, who lives in Mexico, helps her gather information that may be of use. They do have other family living in both the United States and Mexico, including Carlos's brothers. They would be Sheila and Hugo's uncles, who first traveled to the U.S. with Carlos for work. But Sheila and Hugo haven't gotten much information from their own family. So they both post to social media, in English and in Spanish, in dozens of missing persons and unidentified and unclaimed groups. Have you seen Carlos Ariel Delgado Mancha? They include pictures old and new, because Hugo has learned to use age progression apps. He may look like this now. He may have been in Florida or Georgia. He would be 59 this year. The problem lies in location. Carlos had no permanent address at the time of his disappearance. They can't say where he was last seen or by whom. The last police force to interact with him was in Kissimmee, Florida, where he was arrested. Sheila tells us that the local law enforcement there were not interested in filing an additional report on Carlos. She was told that it would have to be pursued through other channels, but that's where things get complex. As far as official paper trails go, Carlos's life stops in 1997. And there's a maze of agencies in this story that make responsibility unclear, and the conclusion seems to be that Carlos remains in limbo. Gone, but not searched for. Not by the people who have the resources to find him. So, how do we begin, or end, the search for Carlos Delgado? There are Hugo's childhood memories, and what information his uncles have been willing to share. What Hugo's mother remembers, the incomplete paper trails from a few court cases, and a delayed report made by one of Carlos's brothers, who was in immigration custody at the time. But ultimately, it seems like it's going to come down to word of mouth, the same way his case got to us, which means we're going to need your help. Sheila and Hugo believe that the best way to gain any traction is to keep Carlos's name and statistics circulating across the southeastern United States. Social media will be the key. Your participation could make the difference. Here's what we know. Carlos Delgado came to the United States with several of his brothers in the 1980s to take part in agricultural work across the South. He left behind his wife and son Hugo and his elderly parents. He did occasionally return to Mexico to visit, at least when his son Hugo was young. And he sent money home to care for his family and to assist his parents. This went on until about 1997, when all communication stopped. During the 1980s, one of Carlos's brothers, Sheila's father, met Sheila's mother, but their relationship didn't last. She spent her life in the United States, while her cousins were based mostly in Mexico. Sheila grew up without much contact with her father's side of the family. In fact, she didn't learn until 2010 that she had an uncle named Carlos and that he was missing. And that led her to Hugo and a reconnection with the paternal side of her family. Here's what Sheila, Carlos's niece, told us about Carlos's past.
I just know that from what I've been told from Hugo, his experience, that he was a very caring and loving person. It's Hugo that's in Mexico that runs the Carlos Ariel Delgado Mancha Facebook page. That's how I know most of my information. Him and I are really close. He's a little bit younger than me, but he does have like very good memory of spending time with Carlos as a kid. He has all these great memories of playing baseball with Carlos when he was a kid. Where they live in Mexico, baseball is like a huge thing. So they have their local leagues, and Carlos and all the brothers grew up playing baseball. They all were raised in northern Mexico. And there was Carlos and three of the brothers that came to Florida in the early 80s. So that's why we don't know too much about everything that happened with them. We just know that Carlos was involved in drugs at a young age. So spent a lot of time on the streets in Florida when he wasn't working, is what we were told by the uncles that lived there with him. they had cards, so they would travel back and forth from visiting the family in Mexico and to Florida. So he remembers him coming for the visit when he would come back and forth from Florida to Mexico.
Sheila also told us what she was able to gather from a former sister-in-law, an ex-wife of one of Carlos's brothers, who she found on social media.
It was an ex-sister-in-law of his that from Florida, and she had told us at the time that they believed he was involved in using crack.
Did you get the impression that because of his drug use, he may have gotten involved in sex work in order to get money?
Yes. And I know that the ex-sister-in-law that we had found and contacted also said that he was very family-oriented. He loved talking about his mom. That's the part that she said she thought that maybe he wasn't alive anymore because she knows that he would have never just lost contact with his mother.
At the time of his disappearance, Carlos's family didn't seek out the media's help. They didn't report him missing for approximately 3 years. That came when Sheila tells us that one of his brothers, Jose, was in ICE custody around 2000 and advised officials that his brother Carlos was missing. We don't have information as to why Jose was in ICE custody at that time, just that he was held. As in the case of many of the missing, there are a variety of potential reasons that Carlos's brothers hadn't reported his disappearance prior to this point. There was estrangement between them in the mid-1990s, so it might not have been clear to them that he was actually missing versus simply not in contact, at least for the first few years. Carlos also had an active warrant out for his arrest as of 1997, so if they were aware of that fact, they may have hesitated to draw any additional attention to him as far as law enforcement were concerned. When Carlos's mother, Hugo's grandmother, died around the year 2000, and there was still no word from Carlos, that may have been the point when Carlos's brothers truly realized that he was missing. It's probably why Jose chose to mention Carlos's disappearance to ICE officials during his detainment in 2000, but because ICE recorded that information, as Sheila told you, she's been unable to open a case with any other department. And she has no evidence that ICE actually has an open investigation into Carlos's disappearance either. When a lawyer inquired into Carlos's name via FOIA, or Freedom of Information Act request, on Hugo's behalf with the federal government, the only paperwork he received in response regarded Carlos's 1988 application for temporary residency status. There was no mention of an active or open missing persons investigation or incident report. And as Sheila said, she has no idea which ICE office to contact. She thinks her uncle Jose was in Texas when he made the report, but she's unsure of the specific location. We've filed requests with ICE in an attempt to clarify if a missing persons report on Carlos actually exists, because if it doesn't, then Sheila will be able to approach Florida authorities again, armed with that information, and she can demand that they open an incident report on his disappearance. For now, though, Sheila and Hugo are forced to operate independently, and that has been extremely difficult. Social media is powerful, but it isn't as concrete as broadcast media. There aren't articles that can be shared or videos or nightly news segments that someone who knows Carlos might watch. They are already fighting an uphill battle with so little information to offer to any possible outlets, and how Carlos's life might be viewed and judged by the public, that makes it even more difficult. If you are a regular listener of this podcast, then you know it can be harder to attract sustained media attention for victims who have addiction issues. Their stories are often shuffled into the background. Hugo and Sheila know that after his move to the U.S., Carlos developed substance abuse issues. They aren't exactly sure when or if he had problems with drugs and alcohol that began in Mexico, but they do know that his day-to-day life began to be significantly affected sometime in the mid-1990s. That's where his arrest record began. He was arrested at least three times. In Kissimmee, in 1993, for defrauding an innkeeper, that's a charge that means failing to pay a hotel or motel bill or restaurant bill. In Tampa, in 1995, for solicitation. And again in Kissimmee, in 1997, for public intoxication and obstruction. Those charges are still tied to an open warrant for failure to appear. So, it's fair to assume that around the time of his disappearance, Carlos was still in active addiction. And that's backed up by the little information that Hugo and Sheila have been told by their relatives, and the former sister-in-law that Sheila tracked down a few years back. Substance abuse issues can affect whether a missing person's case will garner public sympathy. Marissa, the host of The Vanished, deals with this often. When she covers cases of people addicted to drugs or alcohol, she faces backlash from audiences who ask her why she's, quote, wasting time on those kinds of cases. She doesn't listen to the criticism, but the mainstream media is built on clicks. For a family struggling for coverage, substance abuse is strike one as far as mainstream news coverage is concerned. And Carlos is an immigrant from Mexico. This can be strike two for coverage, especially in areas of the country where anti-immigrant sentiment is high. Men's disappearances are more difficult to publicize than women's, and minority men's are more difficult than if they were white. Strike three, strike four. And then comes strike five. As we told you, Carlos was arrested for solicitation. This is not news to his family, as Sheila and Hugo tell us that he was engaged in sex work, which was tied into his addiction issues. Sex workers are much less likely to receive sustained media interest. Add all those strikes up and make it a 25-year-old cold case with no pre-existing resources to draw on, the total lack of Google hits begins to make sense. Sheila and Hugo understand that Carlos was likely in dangerous situations, as people comment every time they circulate his photos. That doesn't affect their need to find out what happened to him. And when the audience is judging the victim, that share post click is less likely to come. And that can be demoralizing to a family who only wants answers. That is not a new concept for Carlos's niece. Sheila's been working as a volunteer on missing and unidentified persons cases for years, before she even knew that she had a missing uncle, in fact. The incident that brought her to this work is a private matter, but it has resulted in her helping hundreds of people.
I'm involved with helping missing people that just become missing crossing the border illegally. I don't speak perfect Spanish, but mine is just having families that don't know the process of what they can do to find somebody, and then people that don't speak the language in the country is who I mainly focus on helping. But I'm involved in many, many cases and many groups, and have become friends with lots of family members that don't know how the process, they don't know when they can file a missing persons report or how they can look for information if they've not had contact with somebody for years. I actually work with this lady that's out of California that also does it just to help people. We never charge anything, and we have actually paid out of our own pockets to send DNA kits to Mexico or to South America for families trying to locate their missing loved ones. And of course, the first thing we do when we know somebody has attempted to cross the border or has is do a DNA test.
Together with other volunteers, including the genetic genealogist she mentioned, Sheila runs Facebook pages in English and Spanish to help publicize the cases of the missing, the murdered, and unidentified. Sometimes the individuals have official case posters and agencies assigned and provided tip lines. Other times, there's only what friends or family can pull together: a selfie, date seen, a colorful background made on someone's phone. Please share. Please text this number. When Sheila Perez began researching missing persons cases many years ago, social media was in its infancy. The tools we take for granted now simply weren't available. Trying to track down a missing person's last known location might lead you to an address or a phone number, but you were left to rely on local law enforcement and traditional media to share their photo and stats with the public and just hope that the right person saw it. Flyers would have to go up anywhere and everywhere. And though many of our current social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook existed, they were new. Today's virality was virtually unknown outside of memes. An everyday person's plea of, please share this, might or might not be heard. And stories simply didn't travel as fast in 2010 as they do in 2022. Brooke spoke with Sheila about the steps she took to begin her search for Carlos back then in 2010 and how it developed.
So when you were in your 20s and you first realized that you had an uncle who was missing, what were your first thoughts and feelings about that?
Well, I don't know. The first thing I did is start trying to see if I could find old addresses, old phone numbers, because I am like a missing persons volunteer advocate, have been for years. So it's kind of something I'm used to dealing with. So that was the first thing we always start with is, you know, trying to backtrack old phone numbers, old addresses, and then seeing if we can find something that maybe we haven't, an address or something that we didn't know. Well, the only thing that we have really found is that we know for sure that he lived in Kissimmee, Florida, and he was in jail. Oh, I know it was October 97. He had gotten arrested and had charges, which he still currently has warrants for because I have talked to the police department. I contacted them and asked how we could do a missing persons report with them. So I have had contact with the sheriff in the area of Kissimmee. And they had just said that, nope, they hadn't had any contact with him because, of course, you know, he would be arrested for his warrants that he had.
So when you called the department to try and submit a missing persons report, would they take that from you?
No.
Did they tell you where you were supposed to go?
They didn't take it. They told me because somehow, whatever in their system, when they look for it and pull it up, it already shows that he was reported missing from when the brother was in the immigration jail.
So is his case still open?
I'm not sure because I've never been able to talk to somebody. I've done so many phone calls to like different ICE offices, and I'm not sure exactly where he was locked up in Texas, but I haven't been able to find a case number or anything like that.
So did the Kissimmee department tell you that you would have to look into the Texas ICE department to find his report?
Yes, just because okay. It was reported in a different state, in a different county.
As we mentioned, we have filed requests with ICE regarding the possible existence of Carlos's missing persons report, and we'll keep you updated on that. But the problem is, there may be some internal notes somewhere of Carlos having a missing persons report, but there's absolutely no public record. He's not listed on NamUs, and we have no solid evidence that a law enforcement office in another county or state outside of Florida would be able to identify him, living or deceased. Another roadblock that Sheila and Hugo have faced has been their own family's willingness to share and talk. This isn't unique to their relatives. Every family has their own approach to a missing loved one. Some want to put the event behind them and avoid speaking of the loss. Others want to actively investigate. And when those conflicting feelings meet, it can cause familial strain. We've heard of families where half of the members want to seek out podcast coverage and the other half don't want it produced. In Carlos's case, no one has actively tried to stop Sheila and Hugo from searching, but they haven't helped either.
It has been very hard in this case. There's other cases that I've helped with that I've gotten way further than on this just because everybody's so quiet about it. We know that there's uncles that have to know more about his everyday life at the time that just for whatever reason doesn't want to talk about it. It's frustrating. I don't know. It's always been just kind of a weird situation with our family. Like the brothers don't like to talk about it. And they tell Ugo and I that it's something that we should just drop and stop trying to push so much for. But we're not sure why they feel that way. There's been times where it's just been like a full family argument we need to just stop digging up the past. But like I said, again, it's like, I don't think they like it because there was so much negativity around like drug use and what he was doing at the time of his disappearance. The older generation just has a hard time dealing with anything that looks shameful to a family, I guess. I think that's why they don't talk about it and why they tell us, Ugo and I, that we just need to let it go because they don't like digging up something that is not a positive for the family, I guess.
So do you think that in their mind, his disappearance is probably directly related to that circumstance in his life? And yes. So they've put it to rest in their mind?
Yes.
We had the chance to correspond with and interview Ugo, Carlos's son, this spring. This was made possible by special content advisor Guadalupe Lopez, who worked on the translation for the interviews, and by senior research assistant Brian Waters, who also speaks Spanish. A major focus of Brian's genetic genealogy research is his effort to expand and build resources and databases for Mexico and Central and South America, particularly Ecuador, where much of his maternal family lives. Expanding records and resources would help the work that Sheila and other advocates are doing too, as well as improve chances of helping to match unidentified persons to missing persons, both reported and unreported. Brian spoke with Ugo about the FOIA he received from the lawyer, the one we mentioned that contained Carlos's approved temporary resident status. Apparently, that came to Ugo via an old friend of Carlos's, who saw some of the posts that Sheila and Ugo circulated across social media. That friend paid the lawyer to look into Carlos's legal issues prior to his disappearance. And the results were copies of Carlos's approved 1988 application for temporary resident status, something that required a background check and a medical exam. At that point, it seems that Carlos had no criminal record. There was some confusion at the time because another Carlos A. Delgado, but not Carlos A. Delgado Mancha, with a February birthday, had an extensive arrest record in Texas. And we noticed that when we pulled up the basic background check on Carlos Mancha, that the other Carlos's records came up too. But Carlos Ariel Delgado Mancha was able to use supporting documents to prove that the man in question from Texas had a different birth year and was much older than himself. Ugo shared that information with us, and it helped fill in some of Carlos's backstory, namely that based on the more than 30 pages of paperwork, Carlos had successfully gone through a complex legal process in the late 1980s to successfully receive temporary resident status. As for Ugo, he preferred that we conduct his interview via email and have someone read his answers. Brian offered to do so, so you'll hear him reading in Hugo's stead in the following section. Keep in mind that, unlike Sheila, Ugo was always aware of Carlos's existence and his presence. Carlos was in contact with his family back in Mexico, visiting and calling. At first it was often, and then eventually, more sporadically, leading up to his disappearance. And just a note, we made some slight syntactical edits so that we could combine some short answers from Ugo into longer sections, but otherwise, Hugo's answers are unaltered. Brooke asked Ugo if he grew up in the same town as Carlos and what that neighborhood was like. She also asked him to tell us what he knew about his father's and uncle's youth and what he knew about their lives leading up to Carlos's disappearance.
Yes, in Monclova, Coahuila, Mexico. My neighborhood was the most beautiful part of my childhood. There was nothing bad about it. We all helped each other out. It is a beautiful family. My grandparents came from a ranch to look for a better quality of life in Monclova. They had 9 children. My father, Carlos, was the 5th born in 1963. They worked selling candy, gum, and newspapers. The older brothers played professional and semi-professional baseball. They worked in the factory in my city, and the younger brothers went to the USA without visas. I have heard many stories about my father that could fill a 1,000-page book. At school, I knew he was calm because he had asthma and he came from a religious family. He got along with his brothers. He was the first one to arrive in the United States and took them to Florida, where he helped them get their legal residency. I imagine he went to better himself and help the family obtain a better quality of life. Afterwards, they struggled with him because they found out he became an alcoholic, was addicted to drugs, and became very aggressive. I found my father was missing after my grandfather had passed away on October 10th, 1997. The last time we'd heard from my father was when he'd called and sent money to pay for the funeral when my grandmother told him she couldn't afford it. Then he only said he was in Georgia.
Brooke asked Hugo if he'd managed to find anything about his father's disappearance once he was old enough to search.
Yes, there are two court cases I found on the internet. For example, legal problems in 1995 and in 1996 for a felony in prostitution. And then again in 1997, with a failure to appear in court. I have seen comments from people on Facebook that say they saw him on drugs and alcohol in Kentucky, the Carolinas, and Alabama. The last one recently said he was in Idaho, that he worked in construction and his payment was in alcohol and drugs.
Brooke asked Hugo whether Carlos's brothers have ever organized a search for him, and if not, how Hugo feels about that in light of his own efforts. She also asked how Hugo's mother has reacted to his need to search for his father.
No, they have no intent to look, because he caused them a lot of problems since he did not understand anything, and because he was very aggressive and fought back. They only say that he is an adult and he knows what he is capable of. I do not know if it is true what the family says. They say he is an adult and that he will reappear later. Maybe I feel sadness because he is their brother, and you shouldn't abandon him. But I respect their decisions. There is a God that sees everything. My mother is very meek and does not speak badly of him, but she also doesn't look for him. She is a very calm and peaceful person.
When Hugo says that Carlos didn't understand anything, he's referring to his father's actions while intoxicated, that he couldn't be reasoned with while in that state. Brooke asked Hugo about his own family, his wife and children. She also asked Hugo how the disappearance of his father has shaped his adult life.
Well, my wife supports me in my search and she helps. She is a psychologist and gives me ideas of where to look. My oldest son carries his name. And sometimes he cries because he says that his uncle is lost because we do not want to tell him the truth. As a child, it was an obsession to find him and listen to the thousands of stories I've heard about him. For me then, he was a hero. Now that I am older, not so much, because I have thought and analyzed things. I cannot judge him. Maybe something happened to him and he might not come back. Only God knows, and I respect his decision. God's timing is perfect. He knows why things happen. There is no anger nor bad feelings towards him. On the contrary, I look for him because I think he needs help. I have been looking for him every day for 7 years without stopping.
For Hugo, that work has mostly taken the form of starting a Facebook page in his father's name. Literally, and using it to spread information about Carlos's case. He uses Google Translate to post any information he comes across online. That might be more detail about one of Carlos's arrests, or the occasional messages he gets from his father's old friends or acquaintances, who are able to pass along tidbits about Carlos's life in the U.S. Those are the things that Sheila and Hugo hope for most. Anything that can help them build a timeline or give them a clue as to where they might look next. Sheila's experience running so many other groups comes in handy because she can reach an audience of hundreds of thousands of people in many countries within minutes. And sometimes that pays off.
So I just repost it, you know, every few months and share it. We have had a few people respond to us over the years. We were told and that he was seen in, what is it called, Marietta, Georgia. Uzo believes, because Uzo said he remembers as a kid, like 90s, that his grandma had mentioned something about Carlos had called his family in Mexico and told them that he was in Georgia. So we're not sure if that's true or not, but we did have a guy message me that worked in the same kind of business. He said it was just a group of Hispanic workers that Carlos had lived with them for a while and worked on refinishing drywall in Georgia.
That lead is one reason we wanted to bring you Carlos's story today. He may have been in Marietta in the mid to late 1990s. Marietta is a North Metro Atlanta suburb in Cobb County, Georgia, about 30 minutes from downtown, up Interstate 75. Listeners who lived in Atlanta, Marietta, Kissimmee, and Tampa in the mid to late 1990s may recognize Carlos and have additional information they can share with Sheila and Hugo. Carlos was known to work in both agriculture and possibly drywall and other areas of construction. He was known to travel throughout the Southeast for work. Based on his temporary residency paperwork, Carlos is listed as a Hispanic male, 5'11", and 180 pounds, with brown hair and brown eyes. In the late 1990s, he wore a mustache. The residency filing includes a full set of fingerprints that could potentially be used for positive identification. Multiple pictures of Carlos are posted on the Fall Line social media, and there will soon be a flyer on our website, in English and in Spanish, which you can view and distribute. View, distribute, like, and share. For now, that's all Sheila and Hugo have, that and each other. Because when Sheila discovered that she had a missing uncle, she also found out that she had Hugo, a cousin she'd never known existed. And that has been a major gift that's also strengthened her need to find Carlos.
Hugo, he's very loving, very caring. We're cousins, but we call each other brother and sister because we're just like best friends. We're so close, he named his last baby after me. And since he's always been in Mexico, I've always been in the U.S., we've never actually met face-to-face. Just we do video calls and messaging, and I mean, we're in contact every day. We definitely became very close over this whole case of looking for Carlos.
Do you have plans to meet up?
Yes, hopefully. Actually, my husband's from Mexico, so we're hoping, he just works all the time, but as soon as we can take a vacation, I want to go spend a couple weeks just with the family and get to know them better, and especially Hugo. We have definitely built a strong bond over this. We're both not willing to quit until we get an answer.
If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Carlos Ariel Delgado Mancha, please reach out to his son Hugo on his Facebook page, Carlos Ariel Delgado Mancha. You can also reach out to Sheila on her group, Desaparecidos en Todo Mexico y Central America. There's a link to both in our show notes. If you know of a case that should be covered on the Fall Line, there's a link to the case submission form in our show notes as well. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is an independently produced show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to fund the Millbrook Twins billboard and to pay for the therapy for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our patrons helps us continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added video live streams, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just a dollar. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kiana Burgess, and Michaela Morrill. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Line editing by Bill Birchinger. Thanks to Special Content Advisor Guadalupe Lopez. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to Private Investigations for the Missing. Please, join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the services of PIs.